Today on Life and Faith.
In a crowded court, when she got a suspended sentence, she threw her arms around me, planted a kiss on my cheek, said in a loud voice so the magistrate and other lawyers heard, "Let me take you out to lunch." And I freaked. Then I thought, well, hang on. I'm a lawyer, but I'm a Baptist minister. I'm following Jesus. What would Jesus do in this situation? And I knew what the answer was. And I said, thank you. That's great. Where will we go for lunch?
Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. Well, this week I'm bringing you an interview with Tim Costello. Tim is well known in Australia as an activist on behalf of the vulnerable and as longtime CEO of World Vision Australia. Tim has just released his memoir, A Lot with a Little. And so we thought it would be a good time to get Tim in, who's actually now working part-time for CPX, to talk about his very colourful life. We'll be hearing about his work in inner city communities, helping the homeless, the drug addicts, the prostitutes, those down on their luck. The people Tim would be quick to say were the ones Jesus liked to hang out with. Also today, we cover Tim's time as mayor of St Kilda in Melbourne. We hear about his family, who honestly would make a great source of an epic novel. And we'll learn about his failed attempts to evangelise AC/DC lead singer Bon Scott. Every part of this story is soaked in Tim's faith and his attempts to make sense of it grounded in real life and real struggle. A quick warning, there's a bit of today's episode that some listeners could find disturbing and might not be appropriate for small children. Tim Costello, welcome to CPX Studio. Great to see you.
A delight to be on the team and to be with you. You're my boss, so I'm going to be particularly polite.
Better be well behaved. We want to focus on your memoir just released, A Lot with a Little. It's a great book. Congratulations on it. I really, really enjoyed it. So we want to talk through some of this. It is your life, so we'll cover it all. I want just to ask, you had a very interesting family, actually. The family history is really engaging. Lots of colourful characters in that family. Now, your parents were obviously a huge influence on you. And one part of that was the Christian faith that they passed on to you. But it was quite different, wasn't it? What was it that is the distinctive combination of those two people and their faith that kind of landed so powerfully for you?
Yeah, it's in writing you look back and see some of the nuances that you didn't see as a child between your parents' faith. It's a shared Christian faith. Both are very committed Christians. But as I describe in the book, the differences in my parents' backgrounds, dad working class, labour, secular family upbringing, mum middle class, liberal party voting, grandma, mum's mum, knew Bob Menzies and as a foundation member. And so they were aspirant. And mum and dad meet at Melbourne University. Dad, a returned soldier. So the war literally gave him his break. He'd left school at 14 in the Depression, couldn't take up a scholarship, and would say to me, "War destroys some men, son, and it makes some men." And in his case, it made him, because he got to get a soldier's bursary, matriculate, met mum at university. So there, mum was in the student Christian movement, which has virtually died out, but it was liberal, not take the Bible literally, engage with science, cultural, really assimilation with what you might call post-Reformation Christianity. Dad was in the Evangelical Union. He, though secular family, had a stunning conversion as a teenager at 19. And he was not just born again. His born-again experience completely shaped our whole family life. But Dad and the Evangelical Union and Mum were the most unlikely couple to hook up. Why? Because people might say they're both Christian, SCM and EU. No, no, no. They were the Sunni and Shia of the Christian world.
Yeah, right.
And their friends were aghast, aghast at their engagement, because the circles, the bubbles they were in just literally didn't like each other. So really, those bookends I reflect on in the book, because this stayed a scripting in our family in understanding faith and profoundly shaped me. And I didn't realise how much until I really sat down and wrote the memoir.
Yeah, and it's very clear from this that it was the kind of deep personal conversion of your dad. And yet he had this sort of otherworldly faith. And yet your mum had perhaps a more kind of intellectual faith. And yet it was all about this world. And you've kind of brought those two things together in lots of ways, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. It took me a long time. As I say in the book, some of my Monash University friends smile and say, we remember when Tim Costello was much more conservative than Peter Costello. So I was on Dad's side of the ledger. The idea is to get people saved, to evangelise. The default position absolutely was conservative politics. But really it was, this world is shafted. And there's not much point trying to redeem it. Mum actually started her theology not with fall, like Dad, and from fall you move immediately to how can I be saved, where is redemption. Mum started her theology with creation, and it's good. And she couldn't see the point of climbing the spiritual ladder for ever greater spiritual mysteries to get to heaven. She said, let's go down and bring some heaven on earth. So she was the one who was utterly hospitable and would always welcome the strays I would bring home. That was her term, strays. They might be kids from the orphanage or kids that I felt sorry for. Dad was the Bible teacher, taught New Testament Greek after school hours at Melbourne Bible Institute for 30 years. Knew his Bible backwards. So we actually believe Dad really understood the faith, and we were a little bit condescending about Mum. And I do reflect on how my own journey came to say that Mum may not have understood the Bible and its minutia like Dad, but she may have understood the deeper message of the Bible in terms of thy will be done on earth, perhaps better than Dad. So I'm reflecting on this in the memoir.
So, Tim, the journalist Philip Adams once described your relationship with your brother Peter as the most interesting sibling rivalry since Cain and Abel, which I thought was a great description. It has had its painful moments, though, hasn't it? And you've been kind of almost accidentally been pitted against one another on some issues. I think the issue of foreign aid might have been one of those.
Yeah, no, I said to Philip, the problem with that analogy is Cain killed Abel. There's no comeback. Look, when you have siblings who are both in public life, it's tricky. My parents, particularly Dad, would always be trying to convince others that Peter and I actually agreed on everything, and that it was only the nasty press that made it up. We were, I think, on the same page, but in different roles. He would say that having financial probity and a balanced budget is good for jobs and justice. I believed in jobs and justice. But there were moments when, John Howard would be saying, why can't you keep your brother under control, when I was demanding Howard might apologise or walk for reconciliation, which Peter did. On aid issues, to Peter's credit, he got the only increase that happened, and I happen to know he argued strongly for it against others in that cabinet.
This is foreign aid, Australian
foreign aid. Increasing it. And the last increase, sadly, it's only been cut ever since, was due to Peter. And people would often say, oh, you and your brother. I'd say, well, do you have a sibling, yeah? Do you agree with them on everything? Oh, hell no. ours just happened to be a bit more public.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Tim, you tell some fabulous anecdotes in this book. You've always been a good storyteller, but please, can you tell us about your failed attempts to evangelise Bon Scott, the lead singer, for those who don't know, of AC/DC, the first one, when you were a kind of somewhat zealous university student.
I was at a Bon Scott concert. I think it was after a beach mission that I was leading. I would have been all of 20, and I got to the tail end of the concert. I don't know what it was in me, but I felt a melancholy as I watched Bon Scott perform. And I lined up behind the stage on the end of about 100 girls who were there to get a picture or a signature from Bon Scott. Yes. Waited my time. And to his credit, he engaged with me. And I, with the full flush of evangelism, said, "You can't really be happy." And he said, "Mate, whiskey bottle in the hand, mate, I've got my whiskey, I've got my drugs, look at this line of girls, I've got all the sex I need, I'm happy, mate."
Thanks very much.
Which meant I had to go to another base of approach. Yeah. But we engaged, I shared my faith with him. It was a few years later, I saw he had died in London, and I felt that melancholy descend again. What if, you know, there'd been a little bit more openness?
Yeah, well, I, as someone who's seen it as my duty to pass on the love of AC/DC to my children, that story really, you know, struck a chord with me, so to speak. Now, and also tell us about your uncle, who was a Maoist. You have such an interesting family, Tim, and your involvement at his funeral. I thought this was lovely.
Yes, so Uncle George was the secretary of the meat workers, and he was a Maoist, not a Leninist, a Maoist. He would go to communist China all the time, an atheist. I remember when I was helping him build his mansion and he had towel rack warmers. I said, "Gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist." Son, he said, "Nothing's too good for the worker, nothing." When he died, the whole of the labour movement came to the funeral. My brother couldn't come because he was suing the meat workers' union, and he would have been physically assaulted. And I'm not being metaphorical there.
No, that would have been a real risk.
And I was asked to do the funeral. They said, "Nothing religious. He's a Maoist." So the funeral began with the Internationale and Bob Hawke and all the labour front bench, and all the unionists are there. And I led the funeral, and I was careful, though it's hard to say nothing religious. You start to say, "We are thankful for his life." Who are we thankful for? No, we can't include God. Got through it. Funeral's over, doors open, hearse is going out, and the Footscray Workers Band that Uncle George started, he started everything in Footscray. He was an extraordinary man. Struck up Amazing Grace. And the comrades, all with tears running down their faces, sang Amazing Grace. And I just reflected, I wasn't allowed to say anything religious, but Uncle George went out to wherever he's gone with Amazing Grace.
That's fantastic. Now, when you and your wife, Merity, were young and in your early stages of marriage, you went to Switzerland to study theology, and this was a very formative time for you. One of the things that was formative was the fact that you went into what was a very multicultural institution. And it's kind of broadened your perspective in all sorts of ways, didn't it?
Profoundly. So much so that I say in the book, and I believe, I don't think you ever understand your faith until you're out of your own culture and have to see it through other cultural lenses. So we're all Baptist students in Switzerland, Zurich, Italian Baptists, and some of the communist countries, British, German, African, Indonesian, all studying for the ministry. So you would have thought we're on the same page. I was profoundly shocked because as a Baptist, alcohol had not touched my lips. And there were the German and English Baptists putting it away. We never smoked. The European Baptists smoked a pack a day. The Scandinavian Baptists had very different views about nudity to what I remember from youth group.
So Baptist was this the start of a descent for you into, I don't know, what?
In some ways, it certainly pushed me to go, what's gospel and what's cultural? The communists, the Italian Baptists, that was the seminary for all Italian Baptist trainees. They didn't have a Baptist seminary. Those Italian students all voted communist. They believed the Christian Democrats, with the Mafia, with even the Catholic Church, would never clean up corruption in Italy. only a communist government would. And I just knew, Simon, God was in heaven, Bob Menzies was in the lodge, and we Christians only voted liberal or conservative.
Yeah, so this is really challenging in all sorts of ways, but it was a very enriching time, wasn't it?
It was profoundly enriching because you had to do Greek, Hebrew and Latin. You learnt to read the text. And the most important part of this was I was away from Dad. My father, who was such, in my eyes, a great man, a humble man, but a great man, that I had never individuated. If I had stayed and studied in Melbourne with him looking over my shoulder, there would have been questions I could never have asked. And I say that because in some ways it was my rebellion. Most have it in adolescence, but I respected my dad so much. My mother said to me at one of my book launches after reading my book, she's 90 now, she said, "Tim, I never realised how much your father was in your head." And to be able to do what he'd done, he'd studied theology at Melbourne Bible Institute, but to do it on my terms, that was actually the really freeing part.
Yeah. Nothing like rebelling by going to theological college. Now, after Switzerland, you and Merity went to a really different environment. For you, went to inner city Melbourne, a very run-down place in St Kilda. And, you know, this was a huge change for you. I want to ask you, though, before you get into some of the detail of that, you did have you established as part of your work there a legal practice to help people because you recognised that there were a lot of people needing legal help. Your first client, a little bit colourful.
Yeah, when she walked in, I didn't even have to ask what her occupation was, the way she was dressed. So St Kilda was and is still the only red light area in Melbourne. And she said, "Can you represent me? I'm on charges of loitering for the purposes." And I said, "Absolutely." Reached for my diary, said, "When's the case on?" She looked at a watch and said, "In 10 minutes' time." I threw on a coat. We literally walked to the St Kilda Magistrates Court from the church, and the legal office was in there, taking instructions. And I couldn't help but see this horrible black eye. And I thought she'd been bashed. I said, "Are you okay? Can I get you medical help?" She was very matter-of-fact. "No, I'm fine. If you need to know, I prostitute for heroin. I reckon with all my priors I'm going inside. I thought yesterday this will be my last big hit." She said, "I got frustrated when I couldn't find a vein in my arm, so I shot up behind my eye, thus the black eye." And I freaked. I thought, I had no idea of this level of violence. Managed to keep her out of prison in a crowded court. When she got a suspended sentence, she threw her arms around me, planted a kiss on my cheek, said in a loud voice so the magistrate and other lawyers heard, "Let me take you out to lunch." Well, I freaked again. And in that moment, you hear voices. I've discovered I hear my mother's voice, particularly whatever continent on earth I'm on. Your mother gets to you and she said, "Timothy, you're known by the company you keep." And then I thought, well, hang on. I'm a lawyer, but I'm a Baptist minister. I'm following Jesus. What would Jesus do in this situation? And I knew what the answer was. And I said, "Thank you. That's great. Where will we go for lunch?" Everyone in court's watching at this point. And she said, "Oh, the Catholic Church puts on a great free lunch." But the walk to the Catholic Church was my orientation, really, to the St Kilda scene. She pointed out other girls working. She pointed out pimps. She said, "It's mainly married men." I said, "How would you get into a car?" Judging her with central locking, not knowing if you're going to be bashed, murdered. She then dissolved all my judgment. She said, "Well, at 15, one of the men who came through Mum's house, who Mum thought she loved, raped me. I tried to tell Mum, she didn't want to believe it, so I left. I ended up at a friend's place until the mother got sick of me, another friend. I ran out of friends. And then I thought, if this is what men do, because I was now homeless, I will at least make them pay." And suddenly, the words, "Judge not that you be not judged." I had no idea of this level of violence, and I was judging her. So that was my first legal client.
Today on Life and Faith, we're listening to an interview with Tim Costello talking about his memoir, A Lot with a Little. Tim had grown up in the Bible Belt of Melbourne in a very suburban environment. And as you would have heard, after studying theology in Switzerland, he spent many years in inner city churches, St Kilda and then Collins Street Baptist Church. Lots of this work was with homeless people or very poor people. I asked Tim, what did he learn from this work and what was the thing he most had to come to terms with as he started this kind of activity well outside the environments he'd grown up in? Here's Tim.
Well, we went to the first St Kilda and then later Collins Street where we started Urban Seed because we really had a question in our heads. And the question was, is faith only useful in what we might call middle-class Bible Belt suburbs? Where we'd grown up, where you knew with the huge youth groups and the wonderful ministries that faith works. Going to the inner city, it wasn't the people that moved out of the inner city, it was just the Christians that moved out. And the churches were more likely to be architect studios or pizza parlours. The needs were overwhelming. So really it was, does Christian faith, as I understand it, in following Jesus work here? And that's why we went there, and I can answer as I do in this book, absolutely it does. It touches lives, it transforms people's addictions. Not always, but I've seen so many miracles.
Did you see enough to kind of think, yes, there's something to this? Because I imagine you could get a bit brought down by this kind of work. It's tough, isn't it?
It's really tough work, and part of the journey for me, and it happened through a woman, Aboriginal woman, Eva, who was in the church when I started the church at St Kilda. I had 10 people, and she was, as we'd now call now, say now, a stolen generation. She didn't know it then. I watched her, being the Mother Teresa, giving away her last $5 to desperate people, and suddenly my faith was challenged. I was going, I wouldn't do that. And I realised my faith was middle class. I'm a futurist. I want to save for that house, that trip, for a good education for my kids. Nothing wrong with that. I don't apologise for it. But Jesus and his disciples lived more like Eva.
Right.
They actually were generous with the little they had. So I started to then pick apart this idea that Christian faith is just middle class. It actually has something to say here. When you take away the judgmental sense, and we saw, not just with Eva, but so many others, wonderful lives turned around with building community and giving them hope and them finding faith.
Mm. One of the things you appear to have learnt through all this work is that it's best to compare down rather than up when you're trying to feel kind of contentment yourself. It's a pretty hard lesson to learn, though, I think, isn't it?
I think it is. I think our society is driven by a dominant story, which goes very simply, the richer I am, the happier I'll be. And it's so invisible and so plausible, it drives us. Well, I can show you a lot of rich people who aren't happy. And a lot of poor people like Eva, who might be on the nose with hygiene, who actually were blessed. When Jesus said, blessed are the poor, I actually have seen it. That sense of faith that God is with me and I can do something was amazing to observe. So comparing up with that invisible, plausible story is what we're all taught to do. And then we feel a victim. We're envious. The nasties appear in us that we're not getting ahead in our career. We don't have the brand labels of others. And we start to die inside. Comparing down, and I learned again this from Eva and the people in St Kilda, you go, I'm grateful. I could be in that person's shoes. And that changes everything. It actually reframes everything.
Now, you wrote that the Bible is not only something of personal impact, although it is that, but social and has social and even political implications. In what sense does it have those things?
Yeah, the Bible, which is a collection of a lot of different sorts of literature written over different times, I think has a central message that what we call heaven is meant to be here on earth, where the lion lies down with the lamb, the child plays by the snake's nest and isn't poisoned. In other words, that peace on earth, that original announcement of Jesus' birth, is the intention. And then it goes very precisely to naming those who are wealthy and are powerful and are malevolent and are greedy and are ignoring the widow, the orphan. Think those on Newstart are ignoring the foreigner in your midst. Think refugees on TPVs. So much of the Bible, and Jesus and the Apostle Paul stood in the shoes of the prophets, saying the reign of God is good news for the poor. So much of the Bible then forces us to ask the questions of who has power in this society and gets what they want, and who doesn't have power and misses out, which really is the definition of politics. Politics is about who has power and gets what they want. And the Bible has Mary, when she's pregnant, the mother of Jesus, singing a song. The rich have been sent away empty-handed, and the poor have been fed. By the way, that Bible reading was banned in Guatemala because it was seen to incite subversion. Dictators don't want that, and those who are powerful don't want it. So for me, the Bible is absolutely personal and transformative, but it addresses what are the barriers to this goodwill on earth.
Now, you did jump in and get involved in politics at one point as mayor of St Kilda, among the other things you were doing at the time. Now, you resisted the temptation to go further in that kind of career. But what was good about that time for you, getting involved in that way?
It, again, came out of my faith. I was reading Isaiah 65. The prophet says, "They shall build houses and live in them. No longer shall they build houses and others live in them." And it jumped out at me. So much of my legal work and pastoral work was with people who once could afford to live in St Kilda. Gentrification was driving them out. And that meant they didn't have access to public transport or the beach in the long summers because they're at the back of Melbourne. So I ran on a platform of putting ratepayers' dollars, St Kilda ratepayers' dollars, into social housing. And quoted that verse at my induction as mayor, where there were raised eyebrows, "Oh, we've got a religious nutter as mayor." St Kilda was the first council to do it. 12% of all housing stock in St Kilda is social housing now because of those policies. Australia's average is 3% of all housing stock is social housing, public, communal, social. Why do we have homelessness? There's no mystery. There's just not social housing for people. Scandinavian countries, even the Brits, have 20% of all housing stock. In St Kilda, I'm very proud that that political excursus away from ministry actually has had lasting legacy in terms of very little homelessness.
We've seen in the West quite a dramatic shift away from church and belief in lots of ways. What do you, as a person of faith and as a pastor, and what do you kind of think people are missing out most on when they've kind of turned away from this part of life that for many people around the world still, majority of people, is essential?
I think all of us try to place some meaning on what seems a lonely, chilled universe that seems very arbitrary. I happen to believe, I won't ever prove this, that there is a God who creates out of love, who intends us to love, and that places meaning on this universe for me. It doesn't solve the problems of why isn't that God, if he's all-powerful, intervening more. I don't know the answer to that, but I do say God's presence in the person of Jesus, who suffers, is betrayed, but still goes on loving and forgiving. And what the meaning of the resurrection for me is that even when you die, as Jesus did, there's a sense of God saying, "I've got this. I can take death into my being, the ultimate fear we all live with, and I'm still God." That I don't understand what happens after death, but for me that presence is so important. I've learned in my pastoral work that whatever programs, handouts you do, they're not nearly as important as presence. I want to know your name. I want you to know you're not abandoned. I want you to know you matter. This is presence. This comes from faith. So the meaning, presence, and also community is a public good the faith creates. Notwithstanding mistakes churches have made throughout history and recently, to gather week by week, to have a morally, spiritually serious topic, to pass around a plate, to organise programs for those in need in your community, to have mentors for your kids in youth groups. Community is fragmenting everywhere in Australia. You know, 40% of Australians eat dinner alone at night. The loneliness of the individualism that I think left and right of politics has served up to us has fragmented community. So for me, that sense of community, which isn't the modern idea which says I prefer choice to community, and choice is my freedom as an individual, I say actually I was chosen. The faith and the community and the meaning gave me a sense of inner connection and a place to plant my feet and to stand on solid ground and to live out my life. So community, purpose, meaning, presence, they are the gifts for me.
Tim Costello's memoir is out now. It's called A Lot with a Little. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And if so, please do leave us a rating or review. Tell your friends who you think might appreciate it also. Join us next time as we continue the conversation with Tim on life and faith.
In terms of being a Christian nation, I said to Rwandans, how can you forgive? And they put it very simply, because God forgave us. This sense that turned my theology on its head. Tutu put it best. He said, no future without forgiveness. And I've seen that in Rwanda.